National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Church membership in the United States fell below 50% for the first time ever, according to a recently released survey. What are the factors in play, and what does it mean for the church going forward? We are joined by Register writer Jonathan Liddle, who has covered the story. And America's political divide grew a little wider this week with an attempt to introduce a bill to pack the Supreme Court by adding four more justices. What could such a move mean for religious liberty? This week on Register Radio, we talked to Register Legal Analysis Andrea Picciotti-Bayer about the implications for the High Court. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen. Hey, Matthew.
Hello, good to be with you.
As always, it's been a very busy week, a lot going on in Washington with this court-packing scheme that has been in the works for quite some time, or at least in the discussions for quite some time, right?
That's very fair. A lot of developments, and we'll see what happens over the coming months. We can be heartened by the fact that Nancy Pelosi has said she has no intention of bringing it to the floor, at least for the moment.
Exactly. I was excited to hear that toward the end of the week. So we'll talk to Andrea in just a few moments. But first, we've got this interesting survey. It was a Gallup poll that showed what has been a very steady decline for the church over many years. I think it's been more than 20 years they've been tracking this. The rate, which is hovered around 70% for decades before 2000, is now only 47%. So Jonathan Liddle has covered this story for us. He's a Register writer. He's just done some great news and analysis stories for us. And he joins us now. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be with you, Jeanette and Matthew.
So this latest story is quite sobering. I mean, it's as you write in your lead, it's not actually surprising, right? As I said, it was a 20-year trend, but why is this considered a milestone now?
Absolutely right, Jeanette. The church leaders I talked to, they said in one sense a three-year decrease from 2018 to 2021 is kind of par for the course. We've been seeing this kind of decline for a while, but I think once you cross that milestone of 50%, we talk about America being a Christian nation, and we can point to some Judeo-Christian principles in our founding, but we're at a point now where less than half of the population belong to a church or a different kind of religious community, like a synagogue or a mosque. And so even if people continue in America to self-identify as religious, and that rate is still, in the 70%, there's this gap between belonging and believing, which can have, I think, significant consequences and impacts on our politics, our culture, and our social life.
So what you're saying is people still consider themselves religious, but without a formal practice?
Yeah, that's what it seems to be the case. I talked to Bishop Andrew Cousins, who's my auxiliary bishop here in St. Paul in Minneapolis, and he is the chair, for catechesis and evangelization for the USCCB's committee. And he said that this fact that you can have still, about 70% of people saying, oh yeah, I'm religious, or I'm Christian, I'm Jewish or Muslim, but less than 50% of that same, that same 100% group of people actually belonging to a church is indicative for him. He referred to Christian Smith, who's a sociologist at Notre Dame, who coined this phrase, moral therapeutic deism. And he said it's an indication that moral therapeutic deism, just kind of in the name of it, it is a belief in God, but it's almost for a kind of therapeutic purposes. Like, God is there to kind of make me feel good. God is there to kind of give me rewards for being a nice person. It's not bad to be nice. It's not bad to be kind. But there ultimately needs to be kind of a deeper surrender in religion, right? It's not that God is just kind of a cheerleader on the sideline, but really we devote our lives to God. And so this gap we're seeing between, believing and belonging, if you will, is indicative that, the kind of religion being practiced in America right now isn't that full surrender, but kind of, more of that therapeutic brand.
And that is a very, very interesting insight. And you say full surrender. I would say humility and obedience. I mean, religion kind of demands that response of us when we actually surrender to it. And really, it's not just religion. We're surrendering in our Catholic faith to Christ and his church, where we believe he is still present. So, wow, what a tremendous insight. Matthew, I think you were going to jump in, though.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, so we're seeing these declines in membership, but are we also seeing sort of commensurate increases in belief in atheism, or what are some of the, when we drill down into these numbers, what are you seeing?
Well, definitely we've seen a significant rise in, you know, what are described the nuns, right? So those who are non-affiliated with, for instance, Christianity or Judaism or Islam or any kind of main religion, right? These are people who even though they're nuns, they might not be atheists. They might describe themselves as spiritual and non-religious. And certainly, you know, in a strange way, just even in weird personal encounters I've had kind of out in the city, you know, people are still spiritual, but in really weird ways. They're into horoscopes. They're into, like, reading palms. I always think, like, you know, Christianity is obviously this beautiful, it includes within it a beautiful fusion of faith and reason. And so once you kind of, like, separate the two, right, and we like to think of ourselves as super rational and empirical today, but, you know, once you separate the two, it's not that the kind of spiritual side goes away, it just kind of gets weird. It just kind of gets disconnected from reason. So I think, you know, I think people will still want to say that actually America is still a considerably more religious, spiritual place than, for instance, Europe is. Like, people will identify at much higher rates in believing in God in the U.S. But I think, you know, if I could go back to the study even, I talked to Stephen Balivant, who is he's an awesome theologian, sociologist based in the U.K., who's written a great book, Mass Exodus, on kind of trends in church attendance in the U.K. and the U.S., and he has another great book coming out, too, on a post-Christian America. But he's really talked about this, and he says you've got to keep in mind, you know, what happened, you know, Jeanette, that you described in 2000, which is the beginning of this gradual drop in church membership from about 70% now to 47%. What caused that were years before, factors a year before. So people, you know, all of a sudden not going to Mass every Sunday, or people, you know, not accepting the church's teaching on this or that. So it has generational effects, because if the parents, you know, stop doing those kinds of things for their kids, it's going to matter even less. So we can say that America is still, you know, a religious nation. You know, 70% of people still say they affiliate with a religion. You know, these nuns, you know, still might be spiritual in some sense. But if we continue to disconnect religious belief from belonging, right? Belonging right. to a community of believers, and the type of accountability and the type of responsibility that demands, it indicates to me that we could, that's likely going to contribute to a continued decrease in the actual belief in God, as it just becomes completely you know, kind of arbitrary.
Personalized, overly personalized, right? To the point that we create it, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like a path of least resistance.
Well, I want to circle back to this in a minute, because I think Bishop Cousins had some examples, small group type examples of how to reinvigorate some parishes and reconnect the community. But you you mentioned that you're in Minnesota. Obviously, this week there's been a lot of news coming out of Minnesota. Really tragic news. Obviously, another shooting of a black man who was pulled over by police. He was shot by police. A police officer who says she thought she was using her taser, but now she's no longer a police officer, and she has also been charged with, I think, second degree manslaughter. So, of course, this has elicited just a response from the people who, after last year's a death of George Floyd. Now there's a trial going on for the officer involved in that. It's just a terrible situation with a lot of unrest, a lot of protests going on. What is your perspective as someone from that state who's living there now, who maybe has even seen some of this up close and personal?
Yeah, so I think it really kind of hit me. I heard about the news of Dante Wright's death. It was obviously Sunday, Divine Mercy Sunday. Right. And I think it was Monday when I was really, you know, on the one hand, it was nice and sunny and warm out, you know, mid-40s, which in Minnesota in April is, you know, like spring break, basically. You know, but there were birds singing, the grass was green, there were, you know, buds in the trees. You know, it's the Easter season, and yet there, you know, again, a tragedy, you know, a killing of a young black man in a police incident. And then the curfews. We've had curfews. We had the Monday night and Tuesday night. And just the ratcheting up of tensions. And this kind, it was kind of like a really sort of ominous presence in the air. And it was really kind of strange for me to experience just because, you know, we have this Easter joy, but yet another tragedy continued. And death, you know, continues to mark our lives, even post-resurrection. So I kind of thought of it as eschatological dissonance, right? Like, okay, it's Easter, I'm joyful, you know, death has been defeated, and yet it still lingers this side of heaven. So, you know, there's a temptation to be discouraged there, but I think the beauty of our faith and the reality of the resurrection is that, it doesn't abolish death in the sense that we don't still experience that, and again, it's a consequence of original sin, but it gives it meaning and it gives hope and purpose. So we can pray for Dante Wright. We can pray, for his soul. We can pray that he's united to Christ in heaven. And certainly we know the resurrection is all about redemption, and we can pray for the officer who accidentally, I believe, you know, shot and killed him, and we can pray for her as well. So it's certainly discouraging in so many ways, but ultimately Christ's death and resurrection is more powerful, and we can still rest and trust in that.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, there's a lot of change, I think, that needs to happen, obviously, all around in these communities. And I think that's one of the things we need to work towards. And you mentioned to me in an off-air conversation just about the need to seek the truth, too, in these, because so often we're tempted to just... I guess emotions, of course, run high, and it's hard to seek the truth in this, and there's a lot of distortion. Mm-hmm. So I really pray that really change comes about so that we can stop having these awful incidents that affect the community so deeply. We're really out of time, but I want to mention a wonderful story that, or it was a blog that you wrote about communio study circles, and this kind of goes back to the idea of how do we get back into a personal relationship with the church and with Jesus so that you know, we're not tempted to create our own religion, if you will. And I'm just going to mention the title of it so people can go and look it up at ncregister.com. This story is called Communio Study Circles Make Theology Concrete, and it's written by Jonathan Liddell as one of his blogs. And I mentioned before a story he wrote about this study, a sober study about church membership. That story's titled Going to Get Worse Before It Gets Better, Religious Membership Decline Prompts Sober Reflection. And of course, that's at ncregister.com. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Andrea Picciotti Bayer to talk about how court packing can affect religious liberty. And we'll also talk about some other religious liberty developments. This is Register Radio on EWTN. More when we return.
This Easter season, read for faith, read for truth, read for life by giving yourself the gift of EWTN's National Catholic Register. Easter inaugurates a joyous season of hope and renewal that brings us closer to God. Gain a deeper understanding of His love and providence in reading the Register. Make this Easter season even more meaningful. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. To get your 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code RADIO. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen. And as we talked about in the intro, there's been a lot going on in Washington this week, especially speculation about packing the Supreme Court. And so let's see, Democrats in the Democrat-controlled Congress announced that they were going to put forward a bill that would pack the court by adding four more justices. And of course, this was immediately decried by Republicans and many constitutional experts as a massive overreach. But toward the end of the week, we had Nancy Pelosi step in and said she wasn't even going to bring this forward. But we need to kind of dissect this and understand really what the dangers are in such a proposal. Of course, we have a wonderful person who joins our team as a legal analyst, especially on issues of religious liberty. This is Andrea Picciotti Bayer, who's with the Conscience Project. Andrea, welcome back to Register Radio.
Jeanette, thanks for having me on. It's always great to be with you guys.
So what a roller coaster of a week in terms of court packing. So where are we really now?
That's a great question. And I'm hoping that we're back to normalcy. Last Friday, the president announced the creation of a commission to study the Supreme Court. He included a number of legal scholars and people who have written on the Supreme Court. And then, just like you said, on Thursday, a number of progressive members of Congress that are Democrats presented their own bill to expand the membership of the court. And it clearly was a blatant attack on the integrity of the court and what is become known in shorthand as packing the court. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, she kind of stood up to that intimidation tactic and said she wasn't even going to bring that bill to the floor. But I think that there has been some damage done. And on Friday, Philip Hamburger, a professor at Columbia Law School, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that this was a dangerous game. And he decried the attempt to intimidate the sitting justices to alter their decision making or to not take cases or to take cases. And I'm hoping that the justices are going to be able to stand their ground and maintain their neutrality.
So, Andrea, as I said, this has an implication not only obviously on just the way the court works, on how it should be independent, as you've just mentioned, but it also could affect religious liberty in a major way. How so?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that we're seeing. The Supreme Court is stepping in time and time again from government overreach. Most recently, we've seen it in related to state and localities enforcing government restrictions related to the pandemic on houses of worship. And it's taken the Supreme Court to step in and protect the right to worship. But religious freedom goes beyond just the right to worship and includes free exercise. And in the last few years, the court has received more and more important cases on our treasured right to free exercise of religion, especially when it comes up against some newly realized civil rights.
Well, gosh, you just segued into a great topic, something you've written about this week in a column that highlights a study. It's a study by scholars Lee Epstein and Eric Posner, and it was scheduled to be published in Supreme Court Review. And this basically says that the Supreme Court, during the tenure of Chief Justice John Roberts, has consistently vindicated religious liberty from government overreach. In fact, 81% of the time these cases rule in favor of religion. You wrote that this isn't very surprising, but there are fascinating details. So what's going on? What does this study show us?
Well, just like we know from last summer, the Supreme Court had several religion cases and in the terms before and has voted in favor of a religion. It's a very pro-religion court. What the study showed, and it's interesting because the authors of the study aren't particularly pro-religion themselves, but mm-hmm. they were looking at the data and they identified that the court even more so than in under prior years, has sided in favor of religion, has sided in favor of both free exercise and kind of explaining the contours of the Establishment Clause. And the authors looked particularly at the personnel behind those decisions, and that recent nominations and recent confirmations of the likes of Samuel Alito, of course, Clarence Thomas, we've got Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and now Amy Coney Barrett, who wasn't included in the study. She came after their review. They have all been very pro-religion, vindicating the rights specifically written in our First Amendment.
Yeah, Andrea, you wrote a review as well of Ken Starr's, yes, that Ken Starr's newest book, Religious Liberty in Crisis, Exercising Your Faith in an Age of Uncertainty. Obviously, this is a book that's touching on the key issues of religious liberty in crisis. What was your takeaway from the book, and is this going to add something to this conversation nationally?
You know, absolutely. I think, you know, Mr. Starr has a profile that's, you know, well-known, very well recognized, and but many few people know that he's a devout Christian. In addition to being a well-known constitutional scholar, he really lives and loves his faith, and that motivated him to write this very helpful book. It's a helpful book for lawyers like me, but also for non-lawyers. And it breaks down not just the cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court, but general principles that underline our notion of free exercise of religion. Some of those principles are the autonomy that religious believers and churches have in our country from government interference, the equality principle that religion needs to be treated fairly. It can't be a second-class citizen, nor can religious believers in the United States. And third, the accommodation principle, that it's good for our country that religious belief can be accommodated, even when it apparently conflicts with other policy interests. It's important that religious believers have a way to continue to contribute in the country without having to leave their faith and their beliefs at the door.
You know, Andrea, I think both of these columns, you know, the one that you wrote, or I guess it was a book review, the Ken Starr book, and this column on the Epstein study, you know, both of these things make me think, okay, it's increasing, the attacks on religion, institutions, and our practice, and there's government overreach, there's lots of overreach that makes us kind of fight back. That's what the study showed, that religious institutions were fighting back and they were winning whenever they presented this all the way to the Supreme Court. But the scary thing is that some people want to frame this as religion, I guess, discriminating, for example, in cases that relate to same-sex marriage or, you know, gender ideology. Why is this not us imposing ourselves? Why is this us really defending what is a right that our country has always granted us?
No, that's a really great observation, and I have two thoughts on it. The first is that the religious freedom protections that we have in the Constitution are against government overreach, government interference with the free exercise. It's not about pitting one group of Americans against another. So it's very important that we understand that. We're not trying to stop other Americans from pursuing their interests. You know, obviously we want to convince the truth of positions, but this is about protecting our right to believe and our right to act accordingly. The second point that I have is bring it on, right? Bring it on, because this is our chance to witness to truths about the human person, witness to truths about the nature of marriage, about the importance of worship. All of these opportunities are a chance to give witness in the public square. It requires an incredible amount of courage and support and prayer, but I think that this is our chance. This is the time that we were put in. God trusts that we can evangelize through these contradictions, and although it's a difficult time indeed, it's a chance that I think we can help bring more people to understand the importance of faith in America.
You know, in your column on the Star book, he makes some suggestions. You know, he says, three important suggestions. Make a difference in your community by engaging in politics. Vote your faith. Is second. Third, become a genuine friend of freedom is third. And fourth is something you added, which is pray. And I think those are very important suggestions for all of us. As we pray and as we watch, what should we be watching for in the religious liberty front?
You know, I think I've been saying this over and over again. I think one of the most important religious freedom cases is going to be decided by the Supreme Court this term. It involves the Philadelphia foster care program run by the Archdiocese and their interest to continue to find loving homes for children in need consistent with Catholic teaching on the nature of marriage. The city of Philadelphia refused to allow an accommodation of that and insisted that the agency place children in same-sex married couple households. I think that it's important for Catholics to be very well informed about this case, to engage, to talk about the importance of foster care and adoption in the Catholic tradition. And also, again, like we said earlier, this isn't about the Catholic Church against same-sex couples. This is about finding a way to continue to keep all doors open for kids in need.
Well, Andrea, I'm going to point everybody to your two columns we've been talking about. One is called Study, Supreme Court Protects Religious Liberty from Government Overreach, and the other, Ken Starr on Religious Liberty. The next crisis is coming. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.